From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. French film star Isabella Gianni is perhaps best known for her performances in François Truffaut's The Story of Adèle H. and Werner Herzog's Nosferatu. Isabella Gianni joins us on this edition of Fresh Air to talk about her past roles and her latest movie based on the life of sculptor Camille Claudel. It's nominated for Best Foreign Film. Also today, we meet TV critic Tom Shales and find out why the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist looks forward to each week's episode of ALF. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Purcell's The Fairy Queen. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a novel by Polish writer Andrzej Sapkowski, a Solidarity member who's now in the Polish Senate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. About 300 Philippine Army rebels agreed today to leave their fortified positions in Manila's business district and voluntarily return to their barracks. The chief government negotiator told reporters the mutinous soldiers would abandon their positions, give up their ammunition, and walk to their camp at Fort Bonifacio about 3 miles away. Earlier today, President Corazon Aquino declared a state of emergency and called for popular support against the rebellious soldiers who launched their coup attempt 6 days ago. East German leader Egon Krenz stepped down as president today, 3 days after resigning as Communist Party chief. Liberal Democratic leader Manfred Gerlach replaced Krenz as interim president, the first time a non-communist has become president since East Germany's founding in 1949. In Czechoslovakia, Communist Party leaders appear to have bowed to pressure from opposition groups for the inclusion of more non-communists in the central government. But the actual lineup of the new government will not be known until Friday, as NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
Civic Forum leader Václav Havel told reporters today he met this morning with Communist Party Secretary Karl Urbanek in an elegant Prague restaurant. It was the first meeting between a party boss and the opposition. Havel said that Urbanek acknowledged that there is widespread mistrust in Czechoslovakia against the party, and he agreed with Civic Forum that the government should consist of young, able people who have not been discredited. After Urbanek, Havel and his delegation met with Prime Minister Ladislav Adamets, who said the new government will be announced publicly Friday, but only after Civic Forum had been consulted. Civic Forum had threatened a general strike next Monday unless the communists yield a larger slice of power. In Prague, this is Sylvia Poggioli.
A Blue Ribbon panel of AIDS experts told President Bush today the nation's health care system is inadequate for dealing with the AIDS epidemic. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
The National Commission on AIDS consists of experts appointed by Congress and the White House. The panel was supposed to issue its first report next August, but the commission decided that the issue was too important. So today it sent its first report to the White House. The commission declared that the current health care system in this country is, quote, singularly unresponsive to the needs of people infected with the AIDS virus. The commissioners recommend a complete revamping of medical care for people with AIDS, although the 10-page report is short on detailed suggestions. Between the lines, the report is, in essence, letting the White House know that the commission intends to push hard for reforms. But at this point, it's not clear how much the White House will listen. This is Richard Harris reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 6 points today to close at 2736.77, declined slightly outnumbered advances on volume of 145 million shares. The average price of a share lost 7 cents. This is NPR News. A California assemblywoman has won a special state Senate election seat in a race that attracted national attention after she was denied communion because of her abortion rights ad campaign ads. Ursula Cromer has more from San Diego.
A victory for Assemblywoman Lucy Calais, who will succeed Larry Sterling in the 39th State Senate District. Calais had been the underdog, but won by a narrow margin, with Republican opponent Carol Bentley officially conceding earlier today. Calais was recently thrust into the limelight after San Diego Bishop Leo Maher publicly censured her from receiving communion. It's a move Bentley says made the bishop a major player in the race, playing right into what she describes as Calais' abortion strategy. She says Calais focused on abortion in order to deter voters from examining her liberal voting record in the state capitol. For National Public Radio, I'm Ursula Cromer in San Diego.
The Casino Control Commission in New Jersey today allowed Caesars Hotel Casino to remain open, but fined it $250,000 for allegedly discriminatory practices against minorities and women. An American explorer said today he has found ancient stone tablets in Peru's highland jungle that may prove the area was the site of King Solomon's legendary gold mines. Explorer and historian Jean Savoy said his discovery may revolutionize the archaeological interpretation of Peru's ancient civilizations. Savoy is a member of the New York's Explorer Club and is credited with discovering 40 lost cities in Peru's remote tropical rainforests in 3 decades. Savoy said he found the 3 tablets, each weighing several tons and measuring 5 by 10 feet, in August at a site 400 miles north of Lima and 9,000 feet above sea level. Savoy said the hieroglyphics on the tablets are similar to those used in King Solomon's time and include one that is identical to the symbol that always appeared on ships sent to the legendary land of Ophir, which the Bible describes as the source of the gold. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of France's biggest stars, Isabella Gianni. In America, Gianni is best known for her starring roles in the films The Story of Adele H., directed by François Truffaut, The Tenant, directed by Roman Polanski, Nosferatu, directed by Werner Herzog, and Ishtar, directed by Elaine May. Americans will soon be able to see Gianni's latest film, Camille Claudel. It won 5 Caesars, the French Oscar, including Best Film and Best Actress. It's also France's official entry for Best Foreign Film at the upcoming Academy Awards. The movie is based on the life of the French sculptor Camille Claudel, who lived from 1864 to 1943. She was Auguste Rodin's first female apprentice, then became his model, muse, and for 15 years, his lover. Her own work was eclipsed by his. When she left him, she lived in isolation and poverty and became convinced that Rodin and his supporters were conspiring against her and her work. In 1913, her family had her committed to an asylum. She remained institutionalized until her death. Claudel's work has recently been rediscovered through a touring exhibition of her sculptures and a biography written by her grandniece. The film Camille Claudel is directed by Bruno Newton and stars Gerard Depardieu as Rodin and Isabella Gianni as Claudel. It was Gianni's idea to make the film. I asked her why she wanted to make it and if she identified with Claudel.
She was a good, purposeful, wonderful part, and she was also, and she most of it, she was this wonderful woman who struggled to get her independence as an artist during her life in the 19th century. And she was a sculptor, which was very uncommon at the time. And she had this wonderful passion with Rodin, and she had everything in life to be a success and to do well and to have a happy life. She was very gifted, and she started very early as an artist, and then everything went wrong. And I was very interested in that. I mean, how come a story can become a tragedy when it starts like a fairy tale? I mean, why does that happen in someone's life and in a woman's life?
Mm-hmm. No, I think her work was recently discovered by people in the United States because of this touring show mm-hmm. and because of the recent book about her. But I was wondering, growing up in France, if you were more familiar with her story than most Americans have been.
Oh, sure. There are several biographies about her, about 5 books by now. That were written about her, and but we only discovered her in 1984. She was unknown to the French before, and that was just an incredible surprise because she was Paul Claudel, who is a very, very famous French writer, sister, and her existence had been hidden for, you know, years and years, and all of a sudden this, the existence of this wonderful woman pops up, you know.
Do you see Camille Claudel as a feminist film because it's in part about how her work was eclipsed by the work of Rodin, who was her lover for 15 years?
It's a film about a woman, so I don't know if a film about a woman becomes a feminist film because it's a film about a woman, but it focuses on this woman and the way she sort of got abused by her brother, abused by Rodin, her lover, and I mean, she was an extraordinary woman. I mean, so it's a feminine film. Not a feminist, I think, in terms of accusing every man to be responsible for her fall. You know, it focuses on everybody's weakness and the bad ways, the bad behaviors some had with her. But she's not a victim, and that's very obvious in the film.
Now, I believe it was you who initiated getting this movie made. How did you begin? What did you do first?
I had to buy the rights to one of the biographies that was written about her. That was written by one member of the family called Rosemary Paris, and I had to address the family because we just couldn't do the film without reproducing the statues if the family didn't agree. And we just couldn't talk about, you know, sculptors' work without showing their work. It would have been just silly. And I had to buy the rights to that, and it was very interesting to meet this family who felt very guilty and wanted to make sure the film was not going to be terrible for them. And then I started to put the money together and ask Bruno Nuitén to direct the film, and a screenwriter called Marilyn Golden, who's American, to participate to the writing. And I sort of, you know, tried to produce it and produced it. And then someone else co-produced it with me, and before starting the shooting, because I needed to concentrate on, you know, being an actress only during the film.
Did you know that you wanted to get Gérard Depardieu to play Rodin?
Yes, I wouldn't have done the film without Gérard Depardieu, and Bruno Nuitén neither. We both were convinced he was the really most perfect actor for the part, and he was just very generous with us. He accepted to be less important, you know, in the story, and participate he participated to the film with wonderful energy and enthusiasm, and he believed in the project from the beginning, and it was just great support.
Sometimes he seems to be in nearly every movie that's made in France. Did he have a long list of films he was already committed to when you asked him to be in this one?
Well, actually, he was finishing a film that had been very, very hard for him. He was very, very tired, and he wanted to take a year off. So when I asked him to do the film, he said, "Oh, no, this is just the wrong time. I mean, maybe next year, maybe, I mean, well," and I said to him, "Oh, well, we won't do the film. I mean, just forget it. I mean, we are so ready. We just can't wait anymore." And I felt, it's the first time in my life I didn't feel like an actress anymore. I just felt like a producer trying to convince another actor, you know, to be with us, and not respecting, you know, what the actor wanted, which was to not to make a movie. And we convinced him he was, and then he... It was great, and he never took a rest.
Actress Isabella Gianni is my guest, and her new movie is called Camille Claudel. There are certain similarities between your new movie, Camille Claudel, and one of your first movies, or perhaps your very first movie, Adèle H. Now, Adèle H. was based on the story of Victor Hugo's daughter, and Camille Claudel and Adèle H. were contemporaries. In fact, there's a Victor Hugo's funeral is one of the events that happens during the story of Camille Claudel. And now both of these women spent the last few decades of their lives in mental institutions, and in both movies, you had to play someone going mad. Adèle H. was shot when you were 19. You're in your 30s now. Has your sense of how to play somebody going mad changed as you've gotten more mature?
Well, you know, the story of Adèle H. was about someone's obsession. Adèle Hugo was very obsessed with this man she was in love with, and obsessed with trying to forget about her father, who was this great man. And she was quite neurotic. I mean, at the moment... when the film starts, I mean, that she's obsessed from the beginning to the end. That's not the same with Camille Claudel. She's a very healthy, full of life, very energetic, not neurotic at all, young girl. She's 17 when the film starts. And then she becomes damaged by life as the film goes on. But I don't think she was mad. I don't think neither of them was mad.
Mm-hmm. Whether you call it madness or not, certainly Camille Claudel loses her bearings in the latter part of the movie. How do you prepare to play someone in that state?
You have to upset yourself sometimes, and accept that. You know, and go through something consciously painful, to give as much truth and credibility to your acting, but that's part of the game, you know. And the game is cruel sometimes. But actually, I was very familiar with her persona before the film started, because I had been... giving some attention to, the writing that was being made about her. I mean, the screenplay. And I sort of got very familiar with her. So I was not scared of anything. I was not scared of the bad moments I would have to go through, as an actress in order to put her pain to life, or her tough moments into the light.
In 1975, when you were starring in The Story of Adele H., directed by François Truffaut, did he give you any advice that stayed with you about how to play that role or how to prepare for it?
I was very worried at the time. I was very worried, not to be good enough and not to do the things right. And he's always told me, well, don't worry, I'll frame you I'll just do things right for you. And you don't need to worry too much about what you should do, etc., etc. And I do. And he taught me a sense of humor, in order to de-dramatize whatever you have to go through as an actress. Or, he took. He loved actors. He would. He took our work very seriously. But at the same time, he didn't want actors and actresses, and he didn't want me to get. To suffer too much, for. And from what I had to do. So one day, I remember, there was a scene, I had to go to the bank and get some money out of the bank. So he said to me, and I kept asking him questions all the time, why does she do that? Why does she think that? And et cetera, et cetera. And he said to me, well, do you know why she's going? With a very serious look, he said to me, well, what do you know why she's going to the bank? And I said, no. Expecting some kind of very, very deep explanation, he said to me, well, she needs some money. And, that's something that stayed with me. I mean, sometimes that's it. That's
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm. My guest is French actress Isabelle Adjani. And she stars in the new movie, Camille Claudel. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Isabelle Adjani stars in a new film about the sculptor Camille Claudel. For 15 years, she was the lover, model, and muse of the sculptor Rodin, but her work was eclipsed in their relationship. She spent the last few decades of her life in a mental institution. Adjani has also starred in the films Nosferatu, The Story of Adele H., and Ishtar. I want to ask you about one of your earlier films, Nosferatu. This is the 1979 film directed by Werner Herzog, and I think it's perhaps the most moving and deeply thought out vampire film I've ever seen. Mm. It's very much about the pain and degradation of living forever while feeding off human blood. And it's also about the adaptability of evil, how it spreads like the plague. I'm wondering what the atmosphere was like on the set when you were making the movie, if the if that sense of evil, you know, was something that was talked about a lot during the making of it, or if it was a very moody set, because it's a very moody movie.
No, I'm going to disappoint you. We had a lot of fun on the set. I mean, Klaus Kinski, who was doing Nosferatu, is very... he loves to joke and he loves to have fun, and he just was making fun of himself, you know, disguised as a vampire. He had to wake up and at 3 a.m. go to the makeup room and then become this monster, and we just laughed a lot about it. And Werner Herzog was very serious about the meaning of the film, and I think one serious person was just enough. we had a lot of fun. We sort of, we did.
I want to ask you about a specific scene. There's a scene near the end where you want to kill the vampire by seducing him at the break of dawn. And if a vampire sees the sun, he kind of withers and dies. You know, the rules of the vampire game is that he's got to be back in the coffin at sunrise. So so you're really kind of giving your life in a way to kill the vampire. And there's a really eerie, beautiful scene toward the end there where you kind of, you know, lay down for the vampire and you take your long hair and move it from the side of your neck. Would you tell me a little bit about that scene, about preparing for that scene and how it was choreographed?
Well, from what I remember, it was... actually, when you say choreographed, it's a very good word, because it was like some kind of dancing. And the lighting was very important, I remember. They were very careful about it. And the costumes and our attitudes were very expressionist, like in German films. And that's what we kept in mind to do the scene. But I do also remember Werner Herzog, not Werner Herzog, but Klaus Kinski's teeth being very, very, very long. And... having problems not to laugh while he was biting my neck.
Well, you never know about watching the movie.
That's what's so nice about it, isn't it?
Now, I understand that both Nosferatu and Adele H, Nosferatu is shot in German, Adele H in French, that they were both shot in simultaneous English versions. How do you go about shooting a simultaneous version in English?
I hate it.
So you have to do every scene a second
Again,
time in English?
Yes, I hate it. I think it's very bad for a film, because it's like making two films at the same time. And it's just, I think it's a bad idea. I don't think that should be done. I just, I don't like to do that. I won't do that anymore.
Who sees the English versions? Because I've only seen the subtitled ones. I think in video stores they have the dubbed ones. What do they do with the English version?
I have no idea. They put it in the garbage basket, probably. I mean, they try it, but I think it never works. I don't know if any movie that it worked for.
So do you feel like you give your all to the original language version and then do a kind of second best job
Absolutely,
when you're doing the English
right.
for it?
I do. Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. 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 Isabella Gianni is my guest. How many films a year do you make?
I do about maybe one film every 3 years, 4 years. I don't know. I don't work very much.
Why is that? I'm sure you get offered a lot of roles.
Well, I love to spend a lot of time on one film. I love to think about it, dream about it, work on it. And it takes time, I think. It's very rare to be offered something that's ready to go and that's just wonderful for you. And I love to enjoy life too, you know, not lose contact with reality and spend time with my friends, my family. I mean, do what I want to do, read, travel. I mean, anything that can make my personal life, richer and more enjoyable. And I don't want to become a movie freak.
The American movies that I know you've been in are The Tenant and Ishtar. Now, Ishtar was such a big Hollywood story a few years ago when it came out, because it was this really expensive production, and it was a real box office flop. I was wondering, when you were making Ishtar, if you had any idea that that was going to happen, if you could tell that it was going to end up being a bomb.
Well, let's say that I never had any hopes for Ishtar. I never spent time having hopes for it. I sort of enjoyed it as Dustin Hoffman did, as a nice holiday in Morocco in the desert. And I think there's a very positive side to Ishtar anyway, because it took Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman, and myself to want to make other films and go back to work as quickly as possible. And Warren Beatty did it with Dick Tracy, Dustin with Rain Man, and I did with Camille Claudel. And that's what Ishtar did for us.
Tell me how you started acting. You were very young.
Well, I started as a child when I was 12. In a movie with children, I mean, that I did during a summer holiday. So it was not a problem for my parents for me to do that, because I was a good school student. And then I did another one when I was 15, again, during holiday. And then I started by chance. I mean, I met some people who sort of were working with the Comédie Française, which is a national theater in France. And then I entered the Comédie Française when I was 16, and I became a classical actress by accident. And then I worked there for about 2 years and a half, and then did a film that François Truffaut saw, and then he hired me for The Story of Adele Age. Everything went very fast and in a very fairy-tale-ish way. It was a very nice time.
Now, I understand that when, because you were still a teenager, you were offered a 20-year contract with the Comédie Française, mm-hmm. and you turned it down?
That's right.
Oh, I was really shocked that there are such things as 20-year contracts.
Yeah. Well, the French are very, very conservative, and they want to, make sure you'll be with them for a long time, if that's what their rules say. In the theater in France, I mean, the national theater is very, very conservative. I guess like the Royal Shakespeare in England probably is. I mean, that's very European.
Mm-hmm. Now, you recently revealed, this was in the past couple of years, I think, that your father was Algerian. In the past, the press had reported that your father was Turkish. Now, the Algerians are pretty much a persecuted minority in France. Why had you before said that he was Turkish and not Algerian?
I didn't. The press did.
Oh, I see. They just assumed that.
That's right. I don't know where it came from.
Uh-huh. What made you decide to publicly correct that and explain your father's origin?
Well, actually, in 1986, there was a terrible wave of racism, particularly against Algerian immigrants, and there was an incredible anti-immigrant propaganda. And I thought it was completely outrageous and horrendous. And I started to say, well, my father was Algerian. And in order to, and to make these people aware they were not, alone in this country. That's why I did it. That's why I did it.
Well, Isabella Gianni, I thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been actress Isabella Gianni. Her new film is Camille Claudel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Eric Clapton. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tom Shales is young enough to have grown up with television, but old enough to remember when the family got its first set. Coming up, the Pulitzer Prize-winning TV critic shares his personal history of television and talks with us about his new book, Legends, Remembering America's Greatest Stars. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of The Fairy Queen by 17th century composer Henry Purcell. And critic Maureen Carrigan reviews The Beautiful Mrs. Seidenman by Polish novelist Andrzej Sapirski. The book was banned because of Sapirski's involvement with Solidarity, but with the recent political changes, the writer is in the Senate and his book is being read in Poland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Rebel troops in the Philippines have agreed to leave Manila's financial district and go back to their barracks. They still continue to hold an air base south of the capital. It's believed some 400 rebels are involved in the evacuation. Terms of a surrender have not been disclosed, but talks had included discussions of the rebels' voluntary return to their barracks in exchange for assurances that they would be treated fairly. A senior Bush administration official in Washington is quoted as saying the coup attempt against President Corazon Aquino has hurt her position and that her ability to survive politically is now in doubt and may depend on how seriously she takes the lessons of the move against her. Just 6 weeks after taking office, former Communist Party chief Egon Krenz has resigned as president of East Germany. Deidre Berger in Berlin has more.
After losing his job as leader of the Communist Party on Sunday, Egon Krenz lost his other posts today. The acting head of state is Manfred Gerlach, a member of a smaller party that was linked until recently with the Communists. No replacement was named for Krenz's now vacant position as head of the National Defense Council. In a resignation letter, Egon Krenz admitted his long years of association with a corrupt Communist Party leadership undercut his credibility as head of state. The government today also announced a general amnesty on December 12th. The amnesty applies to most prisoners, except those convicted of serious offenses, such as murder and drug trafficking. Children in East Germany got some good news today. There will be no more school on Saturday. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Berlin.
Secretary of State James Baker now has an agreement in principle from the Palestine Liberation Organization and from Israel as well, for Middle Eastern talks in Washington. Barry Schweid reports.
The PLO's conditional acceptance came through Egypt, which is serving as a stand-in for Yasser Arafat's organization. Israel gave its okay last month with reservations as well. Now it will be Baker's job to try to settle those differences in a session in Washington with the Israeli and Egyptian foreign ministers. The PLO wants a hand in choosing Palestinians who would meet in Cairo with Israel later in the year. Israel wants to block the PLO from any role, accusing the PLO of still being intent on dismantling the Jewish state. Those are possible roadblocks, and Baker will have to deal with them. At the end of the process would be elections held by Israel on the West Bank and Gaza to set up limited self-rule for the Palestinians. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 5 points to close at 2,736.77 on volume of some 145 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. For some music lovers, Henry Purcell remains the greatest of all English composers. He was born in London in 1659 and died there just 37 years later. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of Purcell's score for The Fairy Queen, performed by the French Baroque ensemble Les Arts Florissants.
Henry Purcell is the composer of the first great English opera, Dido and Aeneas. But most of his work for the theater is in the form of not-so-incidental incidental music for plays. In 1692, he wrote over 2 hours of music for a production of The Fairy Queen, which is an adaptation not of the long allegorical poem by Edmund Spenser, but of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. The score includes preludes, symphonies, and dance music, some of which was meant to be played while the audience was being seated. Five full-scale musical entertainments called masks interrupt the action of each act. The mind-bogglingly elaborate production must have lasted nearly 6 hours. The scenic directions call for a river arched by two great dragons forming a bridge, flying machines drawn by horses or peacocks, and a garden of fountains enriched with gilding and adorned with statues. In the center was a fountain spouting water 12 feet high. The production was so expensive, it had to be revived the following year with additional music to earn back its losses. Of course, the glory of the Fairy Queen was Purcell's score. Its range is astonishing, from the farcical to the romantic to the profoundly solemn and spiritual. For example, here's the comic scene of The Drunken Poet, sung by Bernard Deletre. Les Arts Florissants play with tongue-in-cheek wooziness under conductor William Christie.
I am drunk, drunk as I live, boys as I live, boys as I live, boys drunk. I am drunk, drunk as I live, boys as I live, boys drunk.
Another hilarious scene is the dialogue between an amorous peasant and his coy mistress, who refuses to be kissed until she can be kissed, quote, for good and all. As in the original production, both parts are sung by men. Here are bass Bernard Deletre and countertenor Jean-Paul Fouchécourt.
I tell you again, again and again, maids must never kiss no man. No, 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 no kissing at all. No, 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 no kissing at all. I'll not kiss till I kiss you for good and all.
Not kiss you at all.
No, 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 no.
Not kiss you at all.
No, 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 no.
Not at all.
No kissing at all.
Not kiss you at all.
No, 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 no.
Why no?
No, 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 no.
Why no?
No kissing at all.
No,
no, no, no, no.
Why no, 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 no?
And a kiss till I kiss you for
kissing at all.
Some of the music of The Fairy Queen plumbs unexpected depths, like the second act mask of night, mystery, secrecy, and sleep, which is presented to help Titania, the queen of the fairies, fall asleep. Or the third act mask of the four seasons. The most moving aria is the lover's plaint, O Let Me Weep, with its sobbing violin obbligato. The soprano is Lynn Dawson. This welcome recording of The Fairy Queen is by the French group Les Arts Florissants, directed by the American William Christie. The playing and the singing, if not sublime, are lively, articulate, touching, and full of character. Many critics consider their recent production of Lully's opera Atys, the first performances in over 300 years, one of the major events in the early music revival. Their fully staged version of The Fairy Queen was the hit of last summer's festival at Aix-en-Provence. I hope they bring the entire production to America soon. I want to see that 12-foot fountain.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Purcell's The Fairy Queen on the Harmonia Mundi label. Les Arts Florissants are completing an American tour this week with performances in Boston, New York, and Montreal. This is Fresh Air. Some TV critics seem to have contempt for the medium, but Tom Shales says he's incurably crazy about television. Shales is the syndicated TV critic for The Washington Post. He won the 1988 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. A collection of his columns has been published in a new book called Legends, Remembering America's Greatest Stars. They're appreciations of TV and film stars, including Fred Astaire, Jackie Gleason, Cary Grant, and Gilda Radner, written right after their deaths.
Actually, it's sort of a Polaroid of me, not to sound egocentric about it, but it's my reactions, my emotional response more than anything to the deaths of these people who I held dear, if not near. And so about two-thirds of the book is authentic, sort of immediate period of mourning stuff.
Mm-hmm. Of the people who you write about in Legends, who had the greatest effect on you?
It's hard to say. The first one I ever did, and we made it the first one in the book, was Bing Crosby. And why did Bing Crosby have such an effect on me? I don't know. I always admired not only his singing, I found his voice just terribly comforting and comfortable. But I liked the way he carried himself in public. I liked his jaunty, blithe kind of attitude. I loved the kidding that would go on in the Hope and Crosby pictures. I just thought he had a wonderful, apparent outlook on life. And nothing I've learned about him since, you know, has really changed that impression I have of him. That meant a lot to me. John Belushi, I remember being quite broken up. I was at home, and they called me to say he had died, and I had to drive in for the purpose of writing about him, and I was very, very sad in the car, and I had a tape in the tape player, and it just happened to be some rather mournful Welsh music, and not that John was Welsh, but it just... It just had me in a very sad way because I think one reason that John's death and Gilda's death made me so sad is that we thought of these people as stars who would be around for all of our lives. They were going to be our stars, you know, our generation, sort of our bid to have people join these legends and these semi-immortals. And when Belushi died, it was a bucket of cold water on all of our high hopes, I think.
So are you beginning to take stock of the 1980s now for a retrospective piece that you're working up to?
You know, I have the wonderful feeling I may be able to avoid that.
And, really? Would you like to?
Well, sure. I'd like to avoid work wherever it rears its ugly head. And looking at the 80s, I don't know. Why do we have to look at them? Why not just forget them altogether? I must say they're going out with a bang. I mean, what a news year this has been. It's been quite spectacular. But as far as television in the 80s or the movies, it doesn't seem to me to have been a particularly auspicious decade. It's a decade of great disarray, it seems to me. And I think we're between eras here, and I'm not sure what comes next. But it's kind of a messy situation.
Tom Shales, what shows actually give you pleasure on television now?
Well, nothing gives me more pure pleasure, I suppose, than Late Night with David Letterman, which I find to be the most reliable show on TV in terms of you know, bringing home the bacon and delivering the goods and all those other cliches. And in primetime, I think Cheers not only has held up remarkably well, but it just keeps seeming to rejuvenate itself and is still in very good shape. Probably the best sitcom on now. Murphy Brown is an up-and-comer. I like L.A. Law, even though I usually end up just getting mad because I feel they take a lot of easy, you know, Hollywood liberal answers to things. I feel I'm sometimes getting the Hollywood liberal line. But then they're capable of surprise, too. And the drama is good, the dialogue is good, and the acting is very good. What else? What else is on? And I still like Alf. Yes, Terry, I still like Alf.
Why do
I still
you like
get
Alf?
A kick out of that furry little creature.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't know. It's to me, it's a great idea, and it's a funny show. And I like the idea of a wisecracking alien from outer space.
Uh-huh.
Nobody had done it before.
Now, I noticed you haven't mentioned Doogie Howser as one of the shows that you really like.
Well, it's doing rather well, you know.
It's
the surprise hit of the season.
I have to say, I think it says something about the end of the 80s that the co-creator of Hill Street Blues, where Furillo used to have to ponder the ethics of the way he'd handle all these, you know, problems in the force, you know, that the guy who created that now created Doogie Howser, which is this bizarre fantasy show.
Well, I've always thought Boschko was a little bit overrated, and I've always thought that one of the secrets to his success... Well, now, I don't want to say a little bit overrated and make it sound like I'm dismissing him, because he, you know, he made a great contribution, although we should always remember that Hill Street Blues was created by Michael Kozel and Stephen Boschko, and that L.A. Law was created by Terry Louise Fisher and Stephen Boschko. But anyway, Doogie seems to me the secret of that is lots of sex, and people like to tune in.
You don't mean sex, you mean leering.
Well, yeah, the subject of sex, not right. Not sexual... depiction so much, but people love to look back upon their puberties. Not me. Of course, I'm just barely out of mine, but most people do. Wonder Years is a show that leaves me absolutely baffled by the great success of it, except that people love to get sloppily sentimental about when they were growing up. Now, I don't know. I've never looked back on my high school and junior high school years as the best years of my life, but apparently many people do.
Do you ever watch the program-length paid advertisements on TV, like Robert Vaughn hosting the Hair Loss Show or The
yes.
Credit Card Millionaire?
It's the last stop before Has-Been Hotel, I think, for some of these people. And now that they don't have the Love Boat anymore, they all go and do these. They're called infomercials. How's that for a euphemism?
Yeah, that's yeah. great.
That's one thing the 80s have given us are these not only program-length commercials, but network-length commercials, you know, like MTV or this horrible thing, Movie Time. Is that what it's called? The Movie Time channel, where all they do all day long is plug movies interrupted by more commercials. It astounds me. Or the shopping networks. It astounds me that people will sit still for commercialism that's 100%. You know, it's just pure saturation, all commercials, all day, all night. Who would have thought that anyone could make that work?
Do you remember getting your first television?
Television set. I like to have it called a television set. I don't know why. Because I think of television as the medium. Yeah, I sure do. In fact, little Johnny Knights, who lived next door, gave away the secret. I was on my way home from the grocery store. Is this sick that I remember this now?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay,
no.
Good. Is this pathetic? And I was on my way home from the grocery store, with groceries, no doubt, and little Johnny Knights gave away the fact that we had a new RCA mahogany 14-inch console television set. And, of course, I couldn't race home fast enough. And there he was, howdy doody, in all his black and white splendor. Yes, I remember that well.
So what was your first impressions when you first watched TV in your home?
That this was a miracle, that this was the second coming. And Nirvana, all rolled into one. It was wonderful. And, of course, kids today would think I was just out of my mind talking like this, but you have to imagine that I lived in a small town, and to me this was an electronic link to New York, and not so much to Hollywood then, but to New York and to Chicago as well, where there was some great local TV coming out, including Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, and things like that. So it was opening a world, it was opening a window to me. It was giving me access to, like, theater and the world of New York theater that I otherwise wouldn't only have been able to read about. And there were great things on TV in the 50s. Live drama, of course. We've all heard about that. But there were shows like Omnibus. And Sunday afternoon, then, there were not football games. There were cultural shows put on as public services by all the networks. Shows like The Seven Lively Arts and NBC experiment in television. Can you imagine an experiment in television? We don't have those anymore.
You know, you're mentioning all these cultural shows. This isn't what you like now. Let's face it.
What I like now? Well, it was part of my cultural background. Uh-huh. And well, I don't know. Where are those shows now? You mean like on PBS? They're not the same. Uh-huh. They're not as adventurous, I don't think.
You think so?
Yeah. Wide, wide world. Of course, it's easier to be adventurous when a medium is brand new. Granted. But, you know, wide, wide world, putting the camera in the roller coaster or putting the camera on the back of a horse or whatever it was, something like that was astounding then because it hadn't been done before. And television was this magic mirror.
Were there any shows that irrationally scared you? You know, they left you terrified, and looking back, you can't imagine why.
Well, no, I can't imagine why. The Honeymooners scared me as a child.
It did?
Uh-huh. The idea of a husband and wife fighting with this kind of frenzy, this didn't happen in our house, and it was shocking to me and a little bit scary. It was in later years that I began. I liked the other parts of the Gleason show when I was a kid. I thought Reginald Van Gleason III, a guy who would look at his own mother and say, boy, are you fat. To me, that was just the height of irreverence. This was wonderful to be a wealthy playboy and you know, do exactly as you pleased. I thought that was hilarious as a kid. That just thrilled me no end. But The Honeymooners scared me a little.
So what do you have to watch today?
Well, I just watched the 2-hour return of Beauty and the Beast on CBS, which is on December 12th. Are you curious about that?
Not very.
No. Well, pardon me for mentioning it then.
No, I'm just
what might interest you, pray tell?
No,
Next week's news? I haven't seen that yet.
No, I'm just curious how much you watch each day.
Oh. Well, I watch, I try to watch one of the morning shows, like the second hour. And then I watch an old I Love Lucy rerun. And then I see who's on Donahue and who's on Oprah and who's on that other guy, Geraldo, maybe sometimes. And then I watch an old movie, maybe, or something. And then I go to work. And then I get some serious watching in.
Oh, Tom Shales, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Washington Post TV critic Tom Shales. His new collection of columns is called Legends, Remembering America's Greatest Stars. It's published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, how are you covering Egon Krenz's resignation?
Terry, we're taking a look both at the effects of his resignation and why he resigned, and at the problems that East Germany and Czechoslovakia are having right now in attempting to create an opposition out of whole cloth in countries where the communists have been in power for a long time, and there really is no organized political opposition to take over when all of these things start to change. There's news also from the Philippines, from Colombia, where an enormous car bomb has exploded, killing a lot of people. And we're going to go back to Vietnam with our commentator, Duke Nguyen.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1981, the Polish writer Andrzej Sapkowski discovered he'd become persona non grata because of his involvement with Solidarity. Polish publishers could no longer touch his work. So in 1986, Sapkowski issued his novel, The Beautiful Mrs. Seidenman, through an émigré publisher in Paris. It became a bestseller in Europe and an underground favorite in Poland. This year's political revolution in Eastern Europe changed Sapkowski's status. He was elected to the Polish Senate in July on the Solidarity ticket. The Beautiful Mrs. Seidenman is now available above ground in Poland, and an English translation will be published by Grove Weidenfeld early next year. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of the book.
This past July wasn't the first time that a banished Andrzej Sapkowski was recalled to public life in Poland. He fought in the Warsaw Uprising of 1944, spent the last years of the war in a concentration camp, and then emerged to become one of Poland's leading writers. That experience gives authority to the moral questions about identity, memory, and history that Sapkowski raises in The Beautiful Mrs. Seidenman. His novel reminds me a lot of Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Both books rely on sly, omniscient narrators who pity the other characters' attempts to control their lives in totalitarian societies. The Beautiful Mrs. Seidenman is set primarily in Nazi-occupied Warsaw, though like Kundera again, Shapursky roams freely over 40 years of post-war history. The novel is really a collection of stories about all sorts of people, a judge, a bandit, an SS officer, who are vaguely connected to Mrs. Seidenman. In someone like Dickens, this kind of neurotic design is supposed to confirm the existence of God. But in Shapursky's book, the overplotting creates a paranoid, claustrophobic atmosphere. It's difficult to disappear in Warsaw because everybody knows who you are. Nevertheless, many of the Jewish characters try to assume new identities to survive. Mrs. Seidenman is a blue-eyed blonde who was raised in a secular family and doesn't even feel Jewish, so she passes easily. Her false papers seem to merely complete a process of identity shedding that she began long before the war. Then there's Sister Veronica, a Catholic nun who seizes the historical moment to save a few souls. She hides Jewish orphans in her convent and bombards them with catechism lessons. She's so successful at changing the children's identities that one of them even becomes an avowed anti-Semite. Other characters, like Henio, a Jewish teenager, believe that their identity is the one thing to hold on to in a world gone insane. He leaves his hideout and returns to die in the ghetto. His Catholic friend, Pavel, tries to memorize him, but years later finds it too painful to carry Henio's heroic image with him into the trivial post-war world. Pavel refers to it as a world of shortages, of well-cared-for flower beds but stinking garbage dumps, true freedom, but passage forbidden. That description reveals a problem in reading Shapursky's otherwise dazzling novel. Ironically, his topical political commentary has become dated in just the last 6 amazing months. And his narrator's detached postmodern tone now seems inappropriate at a time when ordinary East Europeans see themselves as players on the stage of history, not just rueful onlookers at some post-apocalyptic carnival. Maybe those novelists who'll eventually write about this year's political revolutions will need to revive the fictional forms of the 19th century, those sprawling historical novels by Scott, Stendhal, and Tolstoy that used to seem so romantic and hyperactive when our own worldview was more resigned.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. We want to welcome all of our new listeners tuning in to KPFT-FM in Houston, Texas. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the first of the guitar heroes, Eric Clapton. Also, we talk with actor Vincent Gardinia about his long career, from acting in his father's Italian-speaking theater company to playing Cher's father in Moonstruck. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.